Let's think about race and the role of race. And race is a little bit like gravity. And gravity is something that we all have. We all have weight. And yet, by some accounts, and there's my friend Gabor in the audience tonight, there are only about 4 people on the planet that really understand gravity. Yet we all are affected by it. And I would posit that race is like that. We're all affected by it, and we all have sort of a common sense knowledge. I'm an expert in race because I've been black my whole life. Or I'm an expert on race because I'm in interracial relationship. Or I'm an expert on, really? That's what makes you an expert? You have weight? That's what makes you an expert on gravity? Turns out weight, race is incredibly, incredibly complicated. And even the experts are struggling with it. And there's some experts, whatever that means, in the audience tonight, Ian Handy Lopez, among others. But at least deserves careful, careful thinking and to understand the work it's doing in our society and how it's actually tripping us up in many regards. So Gunther Myrdal, who was a Swedish social scientist, was asked to come over to the United States and study race. And he was partially asked to come over and study it because the thought was no one here was objective enough or clear enough to actually study race, even though he assembled a team of people from the United States. And he wrote a book that's a classic called The American Dilemma. And the dilemma was this, according to Myrdal: is a country founded on the concept of equality has deep, systematic racial inequality? That's a dilemma. He called that the American dilemma. And one of the questions is, how do we get to that dilemma? And the other, of course, is, how do we resolve it, if we resolve it at all? So part of the way of thinking about this is, what is race? We talk about race being socially constructed. We almost never, though, take time to think about the actual construction of race. So that's partially what we're going to do this evening. So at the beginning of the colony, race as we know it today didn't exist. There were people from Africa, there were people from Europe, there were people working the fields and the plantations, and they didn't organize their identities or their lives around race. They still had identities, but they didn't organize them around race. And the people working those fields were from Europe and Africa, and they worked together. And based on their practice, they married, they had children. In fact, we're only, even now, not getting back to the level of what we now would call racial interaction that was going on in the 17th century. We're not even back there yet. And to them, it made common sense in many ways that they would live together and work together, marry and have children. And they had a rebellion. They had many rebellions. One of the most famous ones called the Bacon Rebellion. And the Bacon Rebellion was actually led by someone who would later be classified as white. The rebellion back then in 1656 was very similar to our claims today. They were demanding access to the process to become members of societies in the form of citizens. They were actually appealing to the elite, saying we should have a say in our lives. And like a lot of these movements, it was also full of contradictions, because they were saying, look, you've taken all this land from Native Americans, we should get some of it. So the contradiction there, they weren't saying give the land back to the Native Americans. They were saying, you're exploiting the Native Americans, why can't we participate in those spoils? And they were relatively successful in that rebellion, and it scared the elites. And the elites basically said, we have to do something. We can't have all these workers working together, coalescing together, having a rebellion together. And they re-articulated the rebellion as a racial rebellion, or as a rebellion pursued by Africans. And they also, over the next several decades, did something. They actually start pulling whites out of that space. Again, they weren't quite whites yet, or Europeans. And they also deepen the practice of slavery. And they said to these newly minted white folks, you have a role to play. And your role is what some of us call the middle stratum. You're not the elites in society, that's us. But we're going to create a middle stratum. And in that middle stratum, you get to sort of identify with us. You get to wave at us. You don't get to be us, but you get to wave at us. And we're going to create something called slave patrols, where you will patrol the people who last week you were living with, last week you were working with, last week you were marrying. You have to patrol them. And every European man could be conscripted to patrol these newly minted slaves, because now they were slaves. And over the course of the next 50 to 100 years, race evolved in some prototypical form as we know it today. And I say prototypical because race has continued to evolve. So the way we think about and did race in the colonies is no longer the way we do race today. And race is a set of practices that I'll get to in a minute. But I want to linger here just for another minute. Because what was going on, which most students of history continue to miss, this wasn't simply the distribution of goods and services. This was the distribution of identity. This was the creation of white identity in the early colonies. And the white identity, which still haunts us today, was that of a middle stratum, the stratum of identifying with the elites and policing the racially non-elites. Policing the racially non-elites. So you want to think about Ferguson? That's where it started. The idea of policing the other. They don't belong. They're different than us. This is also the foundation of the American Dilemma. And so there are classes of people, some who are more or less members and some who are not. And that contradiction continues to haunt us today. So in that effort of policing the other, which has worked so well, we constructed white identity. And that identity is deeply embedded with violence, with othering, and with policing. Now again, it took a long time to get there. People didn't just flip the switch. One week, we're working the fields together. The next week, I'm policing you. So there were a number of laws. There were a number of practices. There were fights back and forth. The anti-miscegenation laws, which came online about 1690. And we call them anti-miscegenation laws, but they really were not anti-miscegenation laws in any broad sense. Because, again, the elites didn't care if blacks by now married Indians or Mexicans, or it was only about whites. It was only creating this special place for whites. And whites would get punished if they continued to marry and intermingle with the racial other, which they did for several decades, which is also counterintuitive. We now think, of course, people naturally want to be with themselves. And we think there's a natural group of folks out there. Our groups are constituted and reconstituted and reconstituted. There are no natural groups. There's no natural groups for whites because there are no natural whites. There are no natural groups for blacks because there are no natural blacks. All of that is a matter of social constitution. Social constitution, not individual constitution, which is one of the mistakes we make, is that I can individually decide my identity. Our identities are always in relationship to each other, structures, and practice. And so we really are going to shift our identity. We have to think about those relationships with each other, the structures, and the practice. So let's come up another couple of hundred years. The country is forming, and we have the Declaration of Independence, and then we have the Constitution. If you think about the formation of the country at the beginning of the Constitution, we had Congress divided into two sections, not Democrats and Republicans. One half were for those who supported slavery. The other half was for those who opposed it. That was the divide in the country up to the Civil War. The most pressing question in terms of political filter was, are you for or against slavery? And every institution that was brought into being prior to the Civil War had to actually go through that crucible, which means that all of our deep institutional groundings were heavily racialized. So think of something like the Electoral College, which we live with today. The Electoral College was, in part, a racialized system. We have a system where the South is going to come into the Union. They want to make sure that they have parity with the North. They don't have as many people. So they come up with this ingenious plan. We are going to count the slaves, who everybody knows is not really people. We're going to count them for the purpose of adding to our ledger the number of people in our state. It's called the Three-Fifths Clause. And some people get confused and they say slaves were only considered three-fifths of a person. Slaves were not considered a person at all. It was the slave master that actually was enhanced by counting the slave, not the slave. And it created relative parity between the North and South. And so the first several presidents, including Jefferson, would not have won without the Three-Fifths Clause. The Three-Fifths Clause stacked the deck in favor of the South and using the institution of slavery to do that. Now, I could do this with all the institutions, and this has actually been done by two authors, a number of authors, but Alesina and Glaser in a book called Fighting Poverty in the United States and Europe, A World of Difference. And they talk about American exceptionalism. What actually produced that exceptionalism? How does that exceptionalism actually express itself? And one of the things they say is that when you look at the exceptionalism, not just in terms of our stingy welfare program, not just our exceptionalism in terms of our possessive individualism, not just our exceptionalism in terms of our racial brawling, but our exceptionalism in terms of our institutions themselves, states' rights, federalism, winner takes all, the role of the Supreme Court. They say all of these can only be understood through the lens of race. Now, this is important because when we think of race, we think about, oftentimes, we default to, when we talk about race, we're talking about black people. Maybe we're talking about Latinos. Maybe we're talking about Native Americans or Asians. But mainly we're talking about black people when we say race. That's the thought. You say race, people think black people. And you always get the question, or I always get the question, why are we even talking about race anymore? Aren't we beyond that? We don't have to see race, and now there are all these people who are not black. They're not white, but they're not black, so can we talk about something else? It's not simply a question of conversation. If you look at our institutional design, how we structure our institutions, how our institutions are different than any other country on the planet, you simply can't understand it without understanding race. So when we talk about race, we're not talking about what black people get. You all are affected by the Electoral College, everyone in here. It's a racialized system. So let me give you a more recent example of that. There's a book by Ira Katznelson, and those of you who are academics will recognize him as a heavyweight. He's a very careful social scientist. And some of you, like my friend Connie Heller, have struggled through 700 pages of his books as he talks about fear itself and how fear helped frame our culture and institutions and some fundamental ways that all of us live with. So he says that there are three primary fears at the time. He talked about war, he talked about the economy, but he also talked about the fear in terms of race. And he says this fear helped shape everything from the 1930s on. So what's an example of that? In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, and then during the Marshall Plan, the government was dealing with high unemployment. It decided to create jobs. We all know the Public Works Program. It literally created thousands of jobs. It built roads, it built bridges, and it put America back to work. But then something happened. The South was concerned because the Public Works Program didn't adhere to Jim Crow. It didn't adhere to the idea that whites always have to be on top. And so the South basically said, you can never do that again. The government can never be in the business of actually creating jobs. It redefined the role of government as outside creating jobs. So when we had the Great Recession, even when we had Democrats controlling both houses and the presidency, we couldn't talk about the government actually creating jobs. What Cass Nelson says is that logic of the government not having a role in creating jobs is a racialized logic that can be traced back to the 1930s and 40s. Again, most of us don't know that. And we think, oh yeah, the government can't create jobs. That's not the government's job. Every other government on the planet will create jobs, but except for ours. Why not? Why is American exceptional in that perspective? Because of race. Now notice, when a government refuses to create jobs, it doesn't just affect black people or Latinos or Native Americans. It affects all of us. It affects the economy. It affects the structure of the economy. So my point that I want to drive home to you is when we talk about race, we're not talking about a discrete number of people. We're talking about America. We're talking about the structure of America. We're talking about who we are. And it goes up and down. It doesn't move in one direction. So we just had an election. And I talked about this middle stratum, whites being the middle stratum, which is also very important because we're not talking about whites versus non-whites. We're talking about a middle stratum, then people who are not in the middle stratum, and the elites. So the idea of focusing on the 1% didn't come from Occupy. It was already there. The elites were already there. And when the elites actually gave birth to this concept of whiteness, they did not count themselves as white. When they said, you can't marry across racial lines, they were not talking about themselves. It's no way they were going to marry anyone who was not elite at all. So when you read the story of Pocahontas, read it from the point of view that one elite marrying another elite. So, oh, isn't that nice, interracial relationship. They're not dealing with race. Elites to elites. Race, that's something the rest of y'all got. We got something else called status and power. The middle stratum, separate, dominating non-whites, allegiance to the elites. So think about this election. Who won? I would say black people didn't win. I would say Native Americans didn't win. I would say Latinos didn't win. I would say Hispanics didn't win. Did white people win? No. Well, who won? The elites. The elites won. The question is, how did they win? Because there are only about 400 billionaires in the country. How is it that they can galvanize the country and win an election? Why are the Tea Party, who are middle class but not elites, why are they so obsessed with shrinking the government? Where does that come from? Okay, a little bit more history. So there's a period of time where the dominant power in the country was situated in the elites. We called it the Gilded Age. We call it the Age of the Robber Barons, where there was extreme inequality, and the country was embroiled in all kinds of fights, the populist movement, the progressive movement, Teddy Roosevelt, where there was this huge fight with the robber barons. And the fight went on for a long time. And during most of that time, the elites won. And then there was this thing called the Great Depression, the crash. And it opened up a window to actually challenge the elites. And Roosevelt took the challenge. And out of that came the New Deal. And so the New Deal was the first real national expression of limiting the prerogative of the elites. Before that, the elites had actually dominated the country. And they dominated in so many ways that it's actually hard to even chronicle what they did. But the New Deal brought a halt to that. Again, how did the elites dominate the country up to that time? It's clear that they did. How did they do it? So before I talk about the dismantling of the elites and the ushering in of the New Deal, I want to talk a little bit about how they dominated the country during the robber baron years. Some of you will know the famous case, the Santa Clara case, where the courts said, for the purpose of the 14th Amendment, corporations are people. And therefore, they get protection as any other person would in terms of due process. It allowed them to go into federal court. It extended protections of corporations against the states, and states hated corporations. Corporations, in their first expression, were not separate from the state. They were part of the state. And they could only be engaged in activity that the state allowed. As they started pulling away from the state, they got into this big contest with the state. And they were able to enlist the Republican Party as their benefactor. And so a strategy became, how do you actually protect corporations, this artificial being that lasts forever? And what they did, they started asserting the corporations deserve the protections of people. And the first big case on that was the Dartmouth College case. The next really big case was Dred Scott. And all of you, even those of you who don't study or practice law, will have heard of Dred Scott. But very few will realize that Dred Scott was a corporate case. The fight was, are corporations citizens for the purpose of diversity jurisdiction, which means they can go into federal court? And the South was very upset with that. They said, if you grant them the right of citizenship, you have to grant it to blacks, and that'll destroy the institution of slavery. And so Taney came up with this ingenious plan, which was, what if we create a super subordinate category for blacks so then we can actually extend a hand to corporations? So we're going to say that we don't have to worry about blacks, whether they're free or enslaved. They can never, never be part of the polity because they are not people. They are not human. They can never be members of our society. Now, can we allow corporations in? That was the move he made. And the court continued to build on that. And so what you see in the courts is that whenever we expand the rights of corporations, we contract the rights of people, and particularly the most marginal people. Those two things go together. So when you think about Citizens United, you also have to think about the voting rights cases. They go hand in hand. So a court that's solicitous to corporations are almost always hostile to citizens. And by extension, almost always hostile to democracy. So we come up to the 1930s. And one of the justices note that of the hundreds of cases that have come using the Civil War amendments, which were the amendments designed to actually bring blacks into the polity, to overturn Dred Scott, to say, yes, blacks are people. The court said, almost all the cases using these Civil War amendments have been used on behalf of corporations, and blacks have been locked out. This was 1937. And we're going to change that. We're going to say, now you can actually challenge corporations, and the court has a special role to protect marginalized populations. That's what the court should be doing. That's what the court should have been doing all the time. And they had a special phrase for it. They call them discrete and insular minorities. groups who don't have political power. They should be protected by the court, not corporations. And it's that decision and those series of decisions that actually was the first expression of the civil rights movement, the first expression of starting to actually change the structures and invite people in. So then we come up to the New Deal, which actually creates a different structure, a new structure, and invites more and more people in. But the South, again, is fighting this. Now, in terms of understanding this country and understanding what happened yesterday, you have to realize we've never had, certainly not since the Civil War, a two-party system. We've had a three-party system. We've had the Democrats, we've had the Republicans, and we've had the South. And the South has always been organized around race. They've always been organized around dominating racial hierarchy. And they will align themselves for a period of time with the Democrats. We had a special word for them. We call them Dixiecrats, because we're saying they're different than other Democrats. Their number one issue, their defining issue, is an issue around race. And they will say to Roosevelt, whomever, we will work with you, but only if you make race a central part of every piece of legislation that comes out of Congress. And so the New Deal was a great deal if you were white. It wasn't such a good deal if you're black. It wasn't even such a good deal if you're a white woman. And so you had all of this legislation designed to challenge corporations, but it could only be done if it was only for whites. So think of something like Social Security. Social Security had a number of exceptions. It covered all the people working, except if you were a farm worker, if you were a domestic worker, or if you're a stay-at-home mom. And with those exceptions, it knocked out virtually all Latinos, all blacks, and all women. But it didn't even stop there. It also said, in case we miss somebody, we're going to let the states administer this program itself so the states could actually catch anyone who might filter through. So this program that created Middle America was a program for a certain group of people that was incredibly racially coded. Now, I said race continues to change. So the New Deal and the Marshall Plan, by creating this social space, for the first time the United States had social welfare in a serious way, it created a new identity, a new white identity. Whites traded in their ethnic identity, Irish American, Italian American, German American, for a new identity called white Americans. And in trading that in, it wasn't just an idea. It's never just an idea. It's like, how do you actualize that? How do you operationalize that? And the way they did it was they created something called the suburbs. The suburbs was the new space that the new white Americans would live in. So we get a new identity in the 1940s and 50s, a new white identity. But at the same time, the government was very clear, this is not for blacks. So it drew a hard line, so it also created a new black identity. And we live with that until the 1960s. And in the 1960s, something happened. We had a powerful expression of the civil rights movement. And that movement basically said, we too, blacks, Native Americans, Latinos, and then later women, we too should be part of society. We too are people. We too want to be part of the social welfare system. And Johnson heard that call, and he said, yes, the New Deal was flawed because it was a racialized movement. We should actually build a society that's fair and inclusive. So he signed a Civil Rights Act in 1964, and he signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. But in signing it, he said, I've just given the Republicans the South for at least a generation. And the Republicans said, thank you, we'll take it. And out of that came something called the Southern Strategy, which was, how do you realign the South? And the South hated Republicans because they had engaged in the war of aggression, which is what they call the Civil War. It was the war of aggression against the South. So they hated Republicans. And the only thing they hated more than Republicans were blacks. And as Johnson welcomed blacks into the polity, that third party shift alliance, and it went to the Republicans. So we used to have the solid South for Democrats, now we have the solid South for Republicans. But here's the deal. The Republicans said, the solid South said, we'll join the Republican Party under one condition. What's that? You have to have an extremely racialized set of activity. That's our issue. That's our number one issue. If you're willing to align on that, we can make common cause. And the Republican Party said, well, you know what? Our number one issue is not race. Our number one issue is big business. Our number one issue is the 1%. So we can figure out a way of marrying a neoliberal agenda and a racial agenda, we have a deal. And that's what they did. And so when you look at the expression of neoliberalism, and Ian's written about this, and I've written about it, his book is called Dog Whistle Politics, that it was an explicit strategy to actually align with Republicans and put blacks back in their place. But the country had changed, and so you couldn't use Bull Connor's language. You couldn't use George Wallace language. You had to have codes for talking about race. You had to develop a new language, a new articulation for what the racial other is. And we started getting things like reverse discrimination, welfare, affirmative action, forced busing. All these terms were codes for, eventually became part of the dog whistle. We're saying to whites, we're against forced busing. So Nixon ran on a platform of ending busing. What's wrong with busing? Was putting blacks into your schools. So the Republicans, against their better judgment, adopted this because it worked so well. And in doing that, they got enough of the votes to actually then starting to restructure the economy. And so when you look at what's happening in the economy, it can only be supported by the winds of intense racialized practices coming from the South. This picture is actually quite clear, but we refuse to see it. And we keep talking about if we could just get whites, poor whites, whites in the South, to recognize their economic interests with poor blacks, then we could have the supermajority and we could really have a fair and inclusive society. But we make that move too fast because we assume that the interests of whites, the interests of all of us, is economic. I'm going to give you some stuff. I'm going to give you health care. I'm going to give you a good school. And in exchange for that, we're going to have a society that includes all of us. Conservative whites have consistently rejected that offer. And when they reject it, we say they're stupid. They're voting against their interests. What's the matter with Kansas? We're offering them stuff, and they're saying no. So this brings us back to the Bacon Rebellion and this slide right here. Who are we? And Samuel Huntington, as you know, asked that question. He's a conservative writer. He says, who are we? And he basically says, in veiled terms, we are a white, Christian, English-speaking country. That's who we are. He doesn't say we're a rich country. He says we are a white, Christian, English-speaking country. What does white mean? White means you can exclude the racial other and you get to identify with the elites. He's saying that's who we are, not what we have. The challenge to hardcore conservative whites is an ontological challenge. We're saying to them, when we talk about diversity, when we're saying to them, when we talk about opening up neighborhoods, we're saying to them, when we talk about opening up schools, that who you are is being challenged. You don't get to police the racial other anymore. You're not the only one to get to vote. You don't get to exclude. If I don't get to do that, who am I? And so what you have is a hard group of whites who are really fighting an ontological death. They believe this is life or death. And they'd rather have less stuff and hold on to who they are, as would we all. We all would trade in stuff for our being. And what the left's mistake has been, they keep talking to conservative whites from an economic perspective, or maybe a political perspective, and I'm not saying they're irrelevant, but not from an ontological perspective. We don't engage the ontological battle. Who are we? What kind of person? What does whiteness mean if you're not excluding and dominating? That's not the whiteness that came into being in the Bacon Rebellion. Think about it in terms of gender. You could say, what kind of man can't beat his wife? Some of us might say, an enlightened man. But for a lot of people, it would be like, no, I'm not a man unless I can hit my wife if I want to. She's an extension. She's my property. It's a dominant role, the right to dominate, the right to control, the right to use force. In many ways, and I write about this in my book, in many ways, that is what white identity was given birth to, the right to dominate, the right to control, the right to use force against the other. Who is the other? Well, the other may change, but it's always the other. So this is the space we're in. We assume that the demographics will save us. I'd say be careful with that. For many years, they certainly didn't save South Africa. For many years, they certainly didn't save Brazil. For many years, they didn't save any country where the largest population are women. Population and power and structure are not the same. There's not a one-to-one relationship. But even beyond that, when we talk about race being socially constructed, is it conceivable that we'll reconstruct race in such a way that Latinos, like the Irish, will become white? A certain proportion of them will become white. Is it even conceivable that certain blacks could become white? Is it conceivable that today we have what I call whites in training? We're teaching people how to become white. It's certainly conceivable. It's also conceivable that people who are phenotypically white will no longer occupy white space. Because when I talk about white, I'm not talking about your skin color. I'm talking about to a set of beliefs and cultural practices that are central to who we are. I'm talking about the ontological space that we hold. And the ontological space that we hold as a society is a space that's fraught with domination, fraught with exclusion, fraught with violence. Can we give that up? And I think we can only give that up if we're offered something as an alternative. If that's not who we are as a country, if that's not who we are as a people, then who are we? Note the conservatives are asking the question, who are we? Are we asking that question? And what I want to suggest is that who we are, or who we can be, and who we can lean into. I see one of my heroes here, Joanna Macy, she writes about this, is that in a sense, the construction of white identity was a identity that was anti-spiritual. It defined itself in terms of being separate, not only separate from ourselves. Think of Descartes. The mind is separate from the body. Reason is separate from emotions. But also separate from each other. I'm a possessive individual. I'm not in relationship with anyone else unless I contract to be in relationship with them. But also separate from the earth. Genesis 1:26, God gave man dominion over the earth and all the living things. Not to live in relationship with, but to dominate and control. To me, that is the cultural space of whiteness. And if you take that away, then who are you? How do we think about relationships that are in relationships? Not hierarchical, but mutual. As Cornel West says, justice, love is the public face of justice. How do we think about relationships that celebrate our interconnectedness and love, and not think about it simply as a psychological perspective, but actually order our societies, order our space, order our neighborhoods, order our schools, so they reflect that. That's a tall challenge, but I think that what we're in society, we're literally fighting for the soul of this country. And it, yes, it's an economic and political fight, but it's also an ontological and spiritual fight. And we have to be willing to engage that. And most of us on the left are very uncomfortable when we talk about spirituality. We're much more comfortable talking about politics. Not that they can be completely separate. But when we talk about ontological, as I suggest, it's profoundly, profoundly racialized. Now, we're here in Berkeley, this lovely church. And my guess is there are probably not a whole lot of Tea Party people here. My guess is that most people would consider themselves left of center. But what I want to suggest to you is that what we know through empirical research is that the left, and by that I specifically mean the white left, have a hard time dealing with diversity as well. That through stuff in the mind science and how we understand are unconscious, these anxieties about not being in control affects not just conservatives, they affect almost all of us. So it's not accidental that three strikes and you're out was introduced in California first. It's not accidental that in the liberal state of California, we have Prop 209. It's not accidental that if you look at the most liberal cities in the country, it's where we have the largest racial disparities. San Francisco, Seattle, Madison, Portland. These are not people who say they hate black people, they hate gays, they hate, but the practice. So it's not enough in terms of what we say. We have to actually look and see what we're doing, what's unfolding. So this may seem like a little bit of a downer. And it might be, but there's some good news. There's a lot of good news. And I talked about contradictory movements happening all the time. So I want to take the last 10 minutes or so and sort of pivot a little bit and talk about some of the things we can be doing to turn this around. And the future is not given. What I do want to suggest is not to just sit back and wait and hope that the demographics will do the work for us. The right wing has a very sophisticated strategy. They've linked together the racial anxiety of whites, particularly conservative whites, but even liberal whites, with neoliberalism. And what I want to suggest to you is that here in the Bay Area, we fall prey to that. I'll give you a concrete example. So think about the big tech companies that are here in the Bay Area. Most of them, from my reading, are what I would call progressive libertarians. They're hostile to government. And they believe, as individuals, if we unleash our freedom and potentials, we could do whatever. We could create an internet. We could create an iPhone. And all that's true. But what we can't create is a society. That a society requires a deep relationship, and it requires the government. It requires collective action. It's not saying it requires the government we have, but it requires a government. It requires power. Because corporations have been attacking government, not because they don't like government, and not because they don't like taxes, that's all true, but they are actually in a fight for power. They are trying to control government. Rawls named this some time ago. He said we could have a capitalist welfare state, or we could have a property-owning democratic state. And one way of thinking about them is that if we say a capitalist welfare state, we make the penultimate good in society corporations or capital, and then everything gets organized around that. Or we can make the penultimate good people, and everything gets organized around that. So I'm not against corporations. It may seem like I am, but I think they're in misalignment. And so if you look at this chart over here, I assert that instead of being the public and private, those two spaces, we have four spaces. One being public, one being private, one being non-public and non-private, and one being corporate. Historically, corporate was part of the public space. It was part of government, but always unevenly. More recently, corporations have actually tried to claim the private space. They've tried to claim we're people too. And private has a special currency in our lexicon, in our culture. Private, from a Protestant's perspective, was where we went to commune with God. It was a sacred space, just me and God hanging out by ourselves. Pretty cool place. Most of the time we hang out now, God's not there, we're just hanging out by ourselves. But corporations are saying, I'm private too. And so we don't want government telling us private folks what to do. We're all just folks in this private space. Corporations are not private. And as we expand corporate prerogative, we actually shrink not just the public space, we shrink the private space. We shrink our prerogatives. And what's the non-public, non-private? Non-public, non-private is where people hang out who we don't really consider people. And we can actually measure at an unconscious level if we see someone as fully human or not. There's a part of the brain that lights up when you see another human being. And when we expose people to that, a lot of times when we see a homeless person, that part of the brain doesn't light up. When we see a young black man, that part of the brain does not light up. They're not seen as human. And in fact, it's worse than not human, because we would treat a deer better. We would treat a whale better. We're hostile to them. We despise them. And so as we expand the corporate space, there's something I call the circle of concern, human concern or life. Things that we love and care about is in the circle. As we put corporations in the middle of this circle, all life get pushed out. All life get pushed out. And at some point, the circle collapse. So I'll say a little bit about Ferguson, then I'll try to give you some uplifting comments, and then I'll stop. Ferguson. So Ferguson's been a long time coming. The slave patrols, that's what Ferguson represent, the modern expression of the slave patrols. But let's quickly come to the 20th century. The civil rights movement is a movement about expanding democracy, about having a real democracy, about possibly having a society that's fair and inclusive. That's what the civil rights movement in its best expression is about. And then it also has some less than best expressions. We acknowledge that. But its best expression was, can we create a society where we care about each other, a caring society, a caring economy? What many conservative whites felt is that the civil rights movement was a threat. What was it a threat to? A threat to my right to exclude, a threat to my neighborhood, a threat to my school, a threat to my way of being in the world. And Nixon is giving a speech when he's running for president, and he's actually running behind. And he gives a speech about law and order. And he's Spike. Whoa, people like that, huh? You like law and order. And then after that, every speech is about law and order. And what he's saying and what people are hearing is that the civil rights movement is a bunch of lawbreakers. They're unruly. They're violent. And we need to impose law and order on the civil rights movement. And Nixon wins. And since then, every president has embraced some notion of law and order. It was Clinton who put 1 million more police on the streets. And it's not just law and order. We didn't stop there. So Reagan said, all right, Nixon, you want law and order. You think that's cool. I want war. So he declared a war on drugs. A war on drugs. And I wrote back then that it wasn't simply a war on drugs, it was a war on black people. A war. And when you have war, you have casualties, including unintended casualties. You don't think of the person you're at war with as a person. It's institutionalizing their otherness. And the thing that sort of runs throughout the way we dehumanize people and ourselves is the issue of belonging or othering. Who belongs? Who is part of the political community? Who is part of the circle of concern? And who does not belong? And if they don't belong, how do we police them to keep them out? And if policing is not enough, we'll send in the army, we'll send in the tanks. So we're back to the Bacon Rebellion. Who belongs? So the claim, at its best expression, of black people, of brown people, is a question of trying to create a circle where we all belong. And when I say all belong, I mean all belong. I mean gays and lesbians. I mean people with disabilities. I mean different religious expression. I mean the Tea Party. How do we create a society where we all belong? How do we create a practice where we all belong? How do we actually claim each other's humanity and thereby claim our own humanity? I think that's the challenge. And I think part of the problem for the left, and particularly, I don't know if you can call them left, but the Democrats, is they don't have a vision. We know what we are against, but they're not presenting anything. They don't have a strategy or a vision. We're waiting for the changing demographics. And the demographics are changing, and they present an opportunity for us. So 15% of people who are married in the United States today are married in interracial, cross-racial, cross-ethnic lines, 15%. The population in 10 years is supposed to rise to 25%. The fastest growing population in the United States are not Latinos. It's actually mixed-race people. What political space will they hold? I bet the Republicans are thinking about that. We're celebrating it, maybe. They're strategizing around it. How do we actually take this possibility and turn it into something good? So I think a few things we need to do. We need to find out to name the anxiety that the country is feeling. People are anxious. We're going through some big changes, and people are anxious. We need to name it. And the anxiety is not primarily economic. It's not even primarily political. Who are we? What kind of relationships? How do we practice these relationships? How do we actually claim a society that is consciously liberal? Which doesn't just mean bringing people in. It also means constraining neoliberalism, constraining corporations, constraining wealth. It means creating a public space where everyone's welcome. We used to like public schools, and then there was Brown v. Board of Education. Now we don't like public schools anymore. We used to like public housing, and then we started letting blacks and Latinos in. Now we don't like public housing. We have to reclaim the public. But I think we can do that. We have to tell stories that celebrate our interconnectedness. And we have to mourn lost life anywhere. Whether it's Michael Brown or a police officer. And we have to demilitarize our neighborhoods. We have to get the tanks out of the Black community. So I'll end by saying this. Think about Katrina. We had a national disaster. And the impulse of the American people, which is incredibly complex, moving in multiple directions, sometimes hiding behind the ideology of colorblindness. I don't see your race. I don't notice that you're a tall Black man. And we know the unconscious notice even when the conscious doesn't. We notice that the structures notice even when the conscious doesn't. We notice our practice notice. Just go to our prisons. So we have these ideologies. We have these aspirations of not seeing race, not doing race. But we are doing it. So let's do it consciously. Let's actually acknowledge our differences, but also talk about our shared aspirations, even as we create them. And I think when we do that, we have to do it, again, not from a space of simply a psychological space, but from a practice space of structures, a practice space of cultures. Then I think we can actually begin to talk about a vision. We can begin to hold the vision. And there will be fights, because there's a lot of money. Again, it's evidence in Richmond that's trying to actually say, this is our earth. This is our environment. You're guest here. This is not your space. We have to reject that. But we have to reject it for all of us. So I think we can do that. And to me, you know, it was sobering. I didn't even want to read the paper this morning. But I think we have to insist that our leaders, if they are going to be leaders, lead and stand for something, that they hold a larger vision. They don't tell us that we have to accept this sort of neoliberal, racialized corporate space. That we not be afraid to name, to talk, to share, but do it from a place of deep interconnection and do it from a place of love. So with that, I'll entertain some questions.
I wanted to start our conversation because you have worked in so many countries and because you made references to South Africa and Brazil, by asking you to put America in context. How different are we? How differently is race constructed in America from in other societies?
Well, a couple of things. The United States is actually at the spearhead in terms of racialization. The United States, in my book, I say the United States was born of two parents. It was born of the Enlightenment Project, and it is a project that gave us, the sort of possessive individualism, gave us a split from nature, gave us rationality, gave us some good things, too. It gave us democracy. So Europe had the Enlightenment Project. The United States had the Enlightenment Project plus slavery. And that's where the United States exceptionalism is really comes from. And also being the stepchild of England. So if you look at English-speaking countries, they actually have a different way and a more pronounced way of doing race than other countries. So in a sense, globalization has always been around. So countries are learning from each other. Brazil, for example, I did a study looking at Brazil, South Africa, and the United States, comparing how they deal with race. So today, as you know, Brazil accepts what we would call affirmative action, as does South Africa. Both Brazil and South Africa is willing to actually name race, and we're not. So in a sense, they're further ahead than we are, but each country has its own cultural expressions of that. Brazil does race so differently. I mean, for example, race in Brazil is color. I say Brazil is a pigmentocracy. So if you're light-skinned, I did research in Brazil with a light-skinned African-American, and people kept saying, why do you keep calling yourself an African-American? You're white. And she said, I'm not white. I'm African-American. She said, and as we were going out into the field, and she was frustrated, she said, so is there going to be a problem with me going out and interviewing Afro-Brazilians and doing this work? And our host said, not really, because in Brazil, we understand that there are a lot of white people in the United States who think they're African-American. So to them, race has never been blood. For us, race, for many years, we assumed race was blood. So if you think of Homer Plessy in the Plessy versus Ferguson case, he was what we call an octoroon. Phenotypically, he was white. But we had the one-drop rule in the United States and the idea of white purity. White purity is not a concept that ever took root in Brazil or South Africa, for that matter. So each country does it differently. But one other thing I would add is that some countries don't organize around race hardly at all in the same way that we do. But what every country organizes around is othering. It's how we other people. And it might be based on religion. It might be based on language. And how we other people not only defines the target groups, it also defines us. So I think that race is just one powerful expression of othering, but it's not the only one.
It's hard to look at the fact that every society creates some categories of difference, of other, that it organizes around, and not come to the conclusion that we're wired to do that, that we're wired to live in small tribal groups and classify many people as outside that circle of compassion.
Well, there, you know, and scientists are actually, there's a lot of neuroscience going on now. And it's like everything else, it gives us mixed signals. We are categorized to other, to create categories. We can't think without categories. But what those categories are, the content of those categories, how hard they are, that seems to be completely social. And so those categories can be fluid. Those categories can be mixed up. So we don't have to do, clearly, before the Bacon Rebellion, people were still categorizing in some way. They just weren't categorizing around this hard axis of race. So it's not inevitable. We can do it differently. And in fact, the 15% who are marrying across lines are doing it in their daily practice. They're saying, this is the person I love. This is the person I care about. So it's not set. There's some things we have to work with, but I think it's much more hopeful than assuming that this is deeply biological or we're stuck with it.
You said Anglophone countries with a historic relation to England are different. England's also the earliest capitalist society. Where do you see the connection between race and capitalism?
Well, Max Weber wrote a book called Protestantism and the Spirit of Capitalism, and what he argued, there's always this fight between dominant institutions, and from about the 13th century on, it was a fight between the church and the new forming state. And the church was quite powerful. The church was, for many years, the most dominant institution in the world, in the Western world at least. And the Catholic Church was, in a sense you could say, more humanizing than the Protestant Church. And I hope I'm not offending anyone by saying this, but I think historically this is accurate. What Weber is saying is that Protestantism, and there are different expressions of Protestantism, but think of Calvinism, which is really hard-edged. It's like, if you're poor, God wants you to be poor. And so literally became a thing of, if someone's poor, it was a sin to help them. Because God put that person there. What are you interfering with God's work for? Leave him alone. And that was coming out of England. And whereas out of much of certainly Italy and other places that had a Catholic expression, the interaction between Catholicism and capitalism created a softer form of capitalism. And there is no one form of capitalism. The way that Japan does capitalism today is very different than the way the United States does capitalism, is very different than the way that Canada does capitalism, is very different. So we use these terms as if they're singular, and they're not. And so what we see is that England had this hard edge culturally and religiously, and then when it got married with capitalism, it was this similar hard edge. So if you think about where the Spanish settled, there was always intermarriage between the indigenous people and Portuguese. And that's why Brazil is much more fluid on along racial lines than the United States was. But England had a very, cut and dry. So that ethos got translated to Australia and New Zealand and the United States. And if you look at the political systems, you see similar things. Proportional representation, which is actually much more inclusive as a design. So looking at the design of societies, proportional representation is much more inclusive than winner takes all. And English-speaking countries tend to have much harder political structures and less inclusive than other forms of structures as well.
On that note, our first audience question, take the racism out of American society, would we still have the same capitalism?
It's almost impossible to say, as I suggest, that in many ways you could say that we have a racialized capitalist system. So if you take racism out, what's left? And it's not clear. You're talking about radically redesigning institutions and structures. But I think, in a sense, that's the charge. The capitalism that we have today came into existence in the 1970s. From the 1940s to 1970, we had a capitalism where it was more inclusive. The country was growing more and more equal. Paul Krugman writes about this in a book called The Conscience of a Liberal. And he does say, which is interesting, because a lot of people read Krugman, he's a Nobel laureate, that you can't understand the United States economy for the last 100 years without understanding race. And actually that's said over and over again by a number of prominent economists. And yet it doesn't sink in. So if we address race, what would capitalism look like? Interesting question, I have no idea though.
So we have a number of questions asking what interventions actually look like in the racialized identities we have today. So one person asks how we demystify the ontological construction of race and corporate personhood in America. Another one wants to know if there's any trainings that successfully change the way cops act. I think they're the same question.
Yes. Yeah, so the latter question in terms of changing the way cops act, yes, cops can be trained. So you asked the question at the beginning, was the police really afraid of, Michael Brown? And I said earlier that, not tonight, but on your radio show, is that most white Americans are afraid of black Americans, certainly afraid of black American men. So when a white person says, I was afraid, it's like, yeah, it's like, isn't everybody, if you were to go around the audience and ask questions, I have those things of, I get on the elevator, people get off, or a friend of mine talk about a first class seat on Southwest Airlines is where a black man is sitting, right? It's first class because nobody's going to sit next to him. It's like, so in that sense, there's a deep fear, but fear is malleable. And one of the things that's I think brilliantly set out in Ian's book is he talks about the anxiety and fear of race is strategically stoked by the elites. This is not just natural fear. They figured out a game plan. How do we make white people really afraid? And they spend billions of dollars telling us encoded messages over and over again, you should be really afraid of black people. All the things, when I was growing up, certainly in the 60s, there wasn't one program on television called Law and Order, unless you think of Dragnet. Maybe that was close enough. But now, you can't turn on television without Law and Order, Law and Order, Law and Order, and black people being arrested. So part of it is that the unconscious actually learns by repetition. If we want good outcomes, we need different repetitions. The unconscious, the mind is incredibly placid. It can shift, it's shifting all the time. And the good thing is, young people have probably a different expression. They still have racial anxiety, but have a different expression than older people. But I would say let's lean into it deliberately. Alpert wrote a book called The Nature of Prejudice in 1954. It's a long time ago. And Tom Pettigrew built on that work. And he said basically when people have human contact in a structured way where no one is dominating the other, you end up having pretty close relationships. People actually, there's one last story. I mean, when the Civil Rights Movement was at its peak, the South was like, well, we got to oppose the Civil Rights Movement. Because if these kids go to school together, there'll be interracial dating and interracial marriage. And the Civil Rights Movement's response was, no, they won't. And of course, the South was right. If you put people together in a certain situation, there will be interracial dating and interracial marriage. That'll happen. It'll happen, and it's happening. So instead of being shy about it, the Civil Rights Movement could have said, yeah, that's going to happen. So it's happening all the time. The way we do race today is very different than the way we did race 30 years ago. And part of it is trying to get a sense of what these new possibilities are. And I think there's another sort of racialized anxiety that's lurking on our environment, and that is basically Chinese. They're becoming the new racialized other. And so we just telling people to be afraid of the Chinese. They are trying to eat your lunch.
How do you confront internalized racism?
So a couple of things. I didn't talk a lot about the unconscious or the mind science today, but some of you who know my work know that I use the term racialization, especially when I'm talking about the unconscious, because the unconscious is actually reading the environment. The unconscious is social. It's not personal, which is counterintuitive, because we think of the unconscious as really being who I really am. The unconscious, because it's responding to repetition, the repetition comes from the outside environment. And so if you have a society where the repetition is that blacks are scary and dangerous, and that's what people see, and that's what people hear on television, that's what people see in stories, it actually affects everybody, not just white people. It affects everybody, blacks, Latinos, everybody. We're all breathing that toxic air. Now, it doesn't affect us all the same, because while I'm breathing that toxic air about black people being scary, I think about my dad. He's not scary. So I have counterexamples to soften that extreme perspective. But I don't call that racism. And Ian and I fight about this forever. One of the few things we fight about. But I think it has racialized outcomes, and we need to do something about it. But I don't think of it as internalized racism. So I'm not exactly sure what we mean when we say internalized racism. I do think there's a lot of racial anxiety, and we can measure that. I do think that's exploited. And I think that, unfortunately, as it's exploited in society over and over again, the left doesn't engage it. The left has ceded the discussion of race to the right wing. And so when the woman running for Congress in Louisiana said the reason Obama can't do well in the South is because he's black, the right wing attacked her viciously of being racist. It's like, how can you say that? You're suggesting that the South, people in the South have racial anxiety or racist? She said, yeah. Or maybe she shouldn't have said it because she's running for election. But someone should have said it. Someone should just put it out there. Look at what's going on in the South. Look at what the Tea Party is saying. 98% of Republicans' elected officials are white. How do we get there? That's race. Let's talk about it. But the Democrats always back away from it. It's like, no, I didn't mean to be racist. I didn't mean to make a racist statement. I'm sorry. In the meantime, the Republican candidate running in South Carolina made a statement that if he were elected president, it would be good for white men. Democrats didn't jump on him. So I think part of it is that we have to engage the conversation. We can engage it in a constructive way that invites all of us into conversation, but we have to engage it. And what I tried to suggest in the talk is engaging it is much more profound than it's happening to black people or it's happening to Latinos. It's like our very structures themselves are profoundly racialized. Can we have a conversation about those structures? Can we change those structures? Can we change the number of black students at Berkeley? If we don't, to me, is a very racialized system. It's not saying the chancellor or the provost or any given person is racist, but the system and the function of the system is profoundly racialized.
How are you not angry?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, I don't think anger is a bad thing. Let me start there. And Dr. King talked about divine discontent, divine anger. And he said basically what he was projecting is that God is angry for the way we're treating the earth. God is angry when we mistreat each other. But I have a pretty wonderful family. Some of them are here. My dad, who's had a much harder life than I have, is really a bodhisattva. He's a Christian, but he's a bodhisattva. He is so loving. People just like to hang around him because he's so loving. And I get sad more than I get angry. And I've actually met and interacted with, quote-unquote, the Tea Party, some Tea Party folks. They really are scared. That's not a trope. In a sense, the people who are maybe most ignoble in our society right now are the elites, because they are strategically, they're not necessarily racist, but they're strategically using anything they can to hold on to power. They would blow up the planet if they could figure out how to make a profit out of it. And then of course I think it helps to have a practice, some kind of spiritual grounding. It helps to have people you love, and it helps to have an audience like the one we have right now.
Where do you draw the line between a useful, righteous anger and an anger that just confirms the fears and anxieties of the Tea Partiers you've interacted with?
Well, I think when we are petty, I mean, we can get angry. Like, someone took my parking spot. Pisses me off, right? I mean, that to me is like not righteous anger. So a lot of our anger is sort of wrapped around in our most minor individualistic needs. We tend to be extremely individualistic, especially on the left. And I've sort of recounted that in the last election, the left would say, if Romney is elected, I'm leaving the country. The right said, if Obama's elected, we're going to succeed from the union. That's a collective act. They're doing something collective. We're still thinking, I'm going to leave, you know, and I'll see you later. It's like, no, let's take the country and go. Let's all of us go together. So I guess I would just say that our actions, from my perspective, has to be inclusive. And I know that's not easy, but I do think that we have to hold on, both at the conscious level, unconscious level, and structural level, the shared humanity. That's our vision from my perspective. It doesn't mean that I won't fight the Tea Party. It doesn't mean I won't fight corporations. It doesn't mean that I will suffer all kind of indignation. But can I do it in a way that still holds on to the person's humanity? To me, that's the challenge.
The conversation you're talking about having, how are the responsibilities of white people to lead that conversation different from the responsibilities of people of color?
Well, I think we're all situated differently. And I talk about this under the context of something I call target universalism. And in our situatedness, individually and collectively, we have different power bases. And that allows us to speak and do things differently. But also, the messenger matters. So if you're saying something, people will hear it differently than I'm saying it. I think it's important for all of us to sort of own this, that this issue in terms of creating a fair and inclusive society is an issue that actually is about all of us. It's not about white people doing something for black people. It's not about black people doing something for Latinos. It's about, can we actually share this planet? Can we recognize our common humanity? And then can we speak to that from wherever we are? And we are in different places. And many of the people in this room have power. There's the Berkeley rep is here, and vice provost from UC Berkeley, writers and authors. So how do you actually own this in all of your both personal and professional spaces? KPFA is here. yay, you know, so I think I'm a little leery if we sort of draw a sharp line. I know there used to be this thing that white people have to talk to white people to save white people. I don't think it works like that. And I think we have to constantly have these iterative processes. I'm not saying we won't at times go off and do something by ourselves. But I think we have to be careful not to reify whiteness. And I think in a really healthy world, all of our identities will actually be fluid. And I sometimes jokingly say, but not completely joking, that in a really healthy world, no one will have to live their whole life as one race, that their racial identity will be fluid. And Zora Neale Hurston suggests that, right? She says, I wasn't a black woman until I got around white people. You know, before that, I was something else. If we think of race as being socially constructed, what are the conditions that are constructing a particular identity at any given moment?
A number of questions asking you to isolate cause and effect for our problems. Do they start with the economic system, or do they start with our consciousness?
If you are a student of systems theory, which I am, suggests that they aren't single causes or single effects. The things are co-constitutive. And it's hard to think of our economic system absent. There's a jazz singer, musician that I like, and he has this phrase. His name is Don Cherry. And he says, the inside is not, the outside is too. So I believe that we are constituted and constituting our environment. We're constantly in interaction with our environment. And I think to sort of try to neatly separate, I think that's it almost slips back into the Enlightenment project. Like, here's an individual, and here's society. Here's an individual, here's the economy. I don't think that individual exists. The individual is always situated in a set of complicated relationships. It doesn't mean you won't, at different times, push in one direction or the other. But I don't think there really is an inside that's separate from the outside. And if you think of something like epigenetics, which is a fancy term for saying that our genes are actually communicating with our environment, and they're changing their sequencing and the gene code. We used to think the genes were inside and the environment was outside. And scientists are now saying, no, well, it's not quite that neat. They're constantly in conversation with each other. So how do we actually understand that conversation? So if we want to fix someone inside, we may need to fix the environment. So I think that goes equally well for the economy. So I don't think they're quite that separate.
Professor Powell, I want to thank you so much for spending the evening with us, and thank all of you for coming out tonight. Please join me in giving a very